It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, sexting is way up among teens, especially during the pandemic, according to new data. We'll look at what's happening and what parents can do about it. First, the Biden administration signed a bill on Thursday that recognizes Juneteenth as a federal holiday. The day commemorates June 19, 1865, as a key moment in the end of slavery in the U.S. It's also known as Emancipation Day. But there have been some mixed reactions to the official designation, with some celebration and some criticism. Our next guest says it's a missed opportunity for the American government to acknowledge what's been taken from Black Americans and the more complicated story of the abolition of slavery. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the official designation of the Juneteenth holiday? If you're Black yourself, does Juneteenth being made a holiday make a difference to you? Did you want something more, something different than that? Are you hoping this can at least jumpstart a bigger conversation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Clyde Ford is the author of several books, including his forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth. He wrote an op-ed piece headlined, "Without a U.S. Plan for Reparations, Juneteenth is a Hollow National Holiday." He wrote that for the Los Angeles Times. Clyde, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for inviting me on your show.
Let's talk about this date itself a little bit. As you point out in your piece, it was a step in the end of slavery. It doesn't really mark the end of slavery. Can you talk a little bit about that history?
Sure. June 19th, 1865, in terms of ending slavery, first of all, on that date, even after that date, slavery is still legal in the United States. Kentucky and Delaware, for example, you could still legally own slaves. And both those places, and including the whole country, really, had to await the 13th Amendment on December 6th, 1865, 6 months after Juneteenth, before slavery was legally ended in the United States. So I don't think there's anything about Juneteenth which is actually true historically. So in that respect, it's really a hollow holiday because it starts based on a set of falsehoods, and yet a lot of people have bought into them.
You point out that one 19th century figure that didn't buy into this was Frederick Douglass, who actually picked another day to celebrate Emancipation Day as August 1st. Can you talk about the significance of that date?
Absolutely. Douglass and many of the other abolitionists in the 19th century recognized August 1st, 1834 as one of the most important dates in the emancipation, or the abolition, I should say, of slavery. That was the date upon which Britain issued a really sweeping, very strongly worded statement about the end of slavery any place in the British Empire, much more strongly worded than Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So Douglass recognized August 1st right up until the end of his life as really what he considered to be Emancipation Day. And I think that's a really strong statement to make in terms of whether June 19th or Juneteenth should be considered Emancipation Day here in the United States.
Can you talk about that kind of piecemeal process that we had in the United States, the Emancipation Proclamation, enforcement in 1865, amendments in the Constitution? It's hard to pick one date.
It's absolutely hard to pick one date, but certainly Juneteenth is not the date to pick. First of all, Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in September 1862. It went into effect January 1, 1863. But the fact of the matter is, and you only have to read the words of the Emancipation only was a statement about freedom for slaves in the states that didn't recognize Lincoln's authority anyway, the Confederate states. So technically, if you were in Mississippi, you were free, but there was nothing about whether you were in Delaware to be free. In fact, you weren't. So it's really, and British newspapers picked upon this really quickly, and they pointed out it's really interesting that Lincoln would issue the emancipation. What it meant was you couldn't own slaves in the United States unless you were loyal to the Union. That was really the hypocrisy, and I think the thing that Douglass and other abolitionists didn't really like. So part of June 19th was that enslaved people in Texas didn't hear about the emancipation until 1865. I have to say that also is a falsehood. The telegraph was used immediately after 1863 and the recognition that the law went into effect. Everybody knew about it, including the enslaved people in Texas. The problem was that the Texas Constitution did not allow for freeing slaves, and Texans fought tooth and nail, even after Appomattox, which happened in April of 1865, as though the war was still going on. So Gordon Granger, the Union general who issued the statement about emancipation in Galveston, wasn't issuing that statement for the benefit of enslaved people who already knew they were free. He was issuing it for the benefit of those white slave owners who wouldn't give up their cause. That's what really Juneteenth is about. It's not about poor blacks who just were too dumb to know that they were free. That's not the truth at all.
Talking to Clyde Ford, author of books including the forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth, looking at the federal recognition of the Juneteenth celebration. He says maybe it's not something to celebrate after all. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Clyde, your concerns aren't just about the date itself, but also about what came after emancipation, whichever date we pick. Can you talk about the concerns you have about beyond that date and why we should still be thinking about it today?
Absolutely. I mean, on Juneteenth, by the time of Juneteenth, what was going on in the United States was this incredible retreat from the first ever widespread act of reparations for slavery. Shortly after, well, first of all, you got to go back to emancipation. Nothing in the emancipation has a plan for what to do with freeing African Americans who were enslaved, other than Lincoln said, well, I hope you get some jobs. If not, maybe you can join the Union Army. But by the way, don't be angry and don't be violent. That's all that was said. The South actually had a plan for what to do with slaves if they want. It was kind of a bizarre plan, but at least it was a plan. So what was put into place and what Lincoln agreed to, one of his generals actually put this into place, General Sherman, was what we technically know, what's come to be popularly known as 40 acres and a mule. And what was behind that was that there was almost 1 million acres of prime farmland that would be given to African Americans because it was taken away from white slave owners. That's the form of reparations. The problem was, Rob, that when Lincoln was killed and Andrew Johnson became president, one of the things he did just around the time of Juneteenth was to pull back and actually negate that 40 acres and a mule plan, also called Special Orders 15, and say, sorry, we're not going to do that. In fact, even though African Americans had started to settle the land that they were supposedly given, Johnson's order forced them to then be taken away from that land. And really, it's this incredible retrenchment on the idea that reparation should be given. So I really see that as one of the most problematic elements of that time, is that the United States started down a road towards reparations for slavery. And because Lincoln was killed, they then decided to do an about face and walk the other way.
Here we are, 2021. Do you see a path toward but making up for that, toward a new reparation?
Sure. I think there's a number of things to consider. And first is, at a local and state level, there have been a number of instances where a city, let's say like Evanston, Illinois, had actually said, look, we really would like to do something that makes up for the way in which African Americans have been treated in terms of redlining and other things in terms of discrimination. So I think, in fact, in Evanston, they've actually established an ordinance which issues, I think, $25,000 to African-American families. There are a number of states around the country, Virginia being one, in which is looking at, you know, what could they do in terms of reparations. I think all that's good. I think that's positive. But I think there is a national response that goes right back to the Juneteenth that ought to be considered. the efforts that were made in terms of reparations, 40 acres and a mule, also called Special Orders 15, that ought to be followed through. The million acres that was destined by that order to be given to African Americans, what should happen now is we should appraise the value of that land. There's all sorts of development and houses, because all this is prime coastal land. The land is probably worth billions, if not trillions of dollars. And that should be the starting point for a discussion about a reparations plan for African Americans. We started down the road. In fact, it was Republicans, all Lincoln Republicans, and many Republicans today try to wrap themselves in the mantle of Abraham Lincoln. Well, they should. They should wrap themselves in the mantle of Abraham Lincoln actually agreeing to a plan for reparations to African Americans and revise the plan. It's still there. It's in the congressional records. The land that was allocated, again, should be appraised. And the value today should be the basis for talking about a reparations plan to African Americans.
We're talking to Clyde Ford, author of several books, including Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth. That's forthcoming. He wrote a piece in the LA Times saying Juneteenth is a hollow national holiday without a plan for reparations. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Juneteenth becoming a federal holiday? Would you like to see federal government action for some form of reparations? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation now with Clyde Ford, author of several books. He wrote the op-ed piece, Without a U.S. Plan for Reparations, Juneteenth is a hollow national holiday, for the LA Times. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org with your thoughts on Juneteenth and the idea of reparations. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Clyde, a common reaction, I think, from white people in particular, when there have been conversations about reparations is, you know, I wasn't around during slave times. My ancestors, somebody might say, came over after 1865. Why should I be on the hook, in effect, as a taxpayer for reparations? What do you say to that argument?
You know, what I say to that is, look, the U.S. Constitution was established in 1787. A lot of people weren't around then, yet we still abide by the laws of the Constitution. We have a democracy not just based on who was here when the laws were created, but who chooses to come to this country and therefore be subject to the laws and the history that was present and created the environment for them. So the fact of the matter is that whether you came before slavery or after slavery, slavery is the basis for establishing a lot of the wealth that took place in this country that was accrued by whites that wasn't accrued by blacks. And the very fact of the privileges and opportunities given to you by this country is because those very same privileges and opportunities weren't given to another group of people. So regardless of when you came, the idea that reparations is owed to African Americans, I think, is a valid argument. We certainly did it with Japanese during the war, and there are many people who had nothing to do with that, yet still the country decided that that was something worthy to do.
Let's go to our callers now. Kenneth is with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
And that the army was an occupational army by that time in Texas, but there was a lot of skullduggery going around, I'm sure. And I first heard the proclamation today made by the army in 1865 on Juneteenth. And they were told that they would become employees immediately. But as bad as it sounds, could the slaveholder say, you know, I paid for you, you're going to have to work off what I paid before I'm going to start giving you more money?
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Clyde, you write some about the condition of black people in the South after they were freed. Were they in effect forced into labor?
Oh, absolutely. same, the period after slavery, you know, that period where blacks were no longer slaves, but were actually sharecroppers. Actually, it was just slavery in another name. Blacks were in essentially a company store where white slave owners were now simply their employers who basically said, okay, you got to work for me, but you also have to pay for everything, your lodging, your food, and everything else. And the overseers who were once overseers under slavery simply became the labor bosses during this time of sharecropping. So right after the Civil War, there was little change. I mean, Jim Crow took place, and you had all these egregious laws, voter suppression, some of the things you even see going on right now in the country in terms of retrenching or retreating from widespread voting. Those were happening right after slavery. So absolutely, African-Americans were struggling. It wasn't just everything was great because of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Thanks for the call, Kenneth. We'll go now to Bill in Superior. Bill, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, slavery was a horrible, horrible thing that happened in our history, or any history for that matter. And we need to learn from the mistakes that were made in the past. However, the idea of reparation, I feel is ridiculous, being the fact that nobody in today's society had absolutely anything to do with what happened back then. It's kind of as if you were to say that my great-great-great uncle rode a horse for Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo promised him a pension when he got to a certain age, but they didn't give him that pension. Now I'm entitled to that pension. That's a ridiculous argument.
Bill, thanks for the call. Clyde?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and certainly you hear that a lot. But the challenge is that wealth in this country is built upon historical wealth in families. And the historical wealth in families was denied to those who were denied the opportunity to build wealth, like the enslaved black men and women in this country. So had those people actually been working for wages, just like that fellow who was riding for Wells Fargo, then they would have accrued to themselves and passed on to their family a wealth which we would now see no longer this huge income gap between black and white families. So that's the basis for this. Not just that they're owed for the hardships, but the fact is that they were denied the opportunity to generate wealth that everybody else was given that opportunity to do, and therefore right now they are not in an equitable position in terms of income and in terms of wealth. That's what the basis of a reparations argument is.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call, and Clyde, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, I really appreciate it. Look forward to coming back on Central Time sometime in the future.
That's Clyde Ford, author of several books, including his forthcoming Of Blood and Sweat, Black Lives and the Making of White Power and Wealth. He wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about Juneteenth and reparations. Art Preserve in Sheboygan officially opened Saturday after being delayed by the coronavirus pandemic. An annex of the John Michael Kohler Arts Center, the museum will make history as the first ever dedicated to artist-built environments. Megan Hart has more.
On the museum's first floor, there's an enclosed section dedicated to the Milwaukee County artist Eugene von Brinkenhain. It's 1,600 square feet, but it feels smaller.
And this is the actual footprint of his house. It's not the layout, but it is the size to kind of give people a sense of how dense they must have been living.
It's filled with towering display cases full of his colorful creations. Curator Laura Bickford says von Brinkenhain made profusely, painting, writing, and photographing his wife, Marie.
He dug clay from his yard and made crowns and vessels that he would fire in his oven.
Back in April, many of his works were already in place, but there were still a couple of empty spots. They were waiting on von Brinkenhain's towers, made from poultry bones and model airplane glue. Some are several feet tall, and moving them is no easy task. In fact, it highlights one of Art Preserve's central themes. How do we conserve and display works that were never meant for museums? In a way, the story of Art Preserve starts with von Brinkenhain. Ruth Kohler, former director of the John Michael Kohler Art Center, visited his home in West Allis after he died in 1983.
She instantly sort of realized, like, we can't just have one painting. Like, no one will understand the kind of breadth and depth of his world. And so the first acquisition the Art Center made was about 6,000 objects that came out of his house.
Art Preserve isn't just for outsider art. The museum doesn't even use the term. In fact, its collection includes some real art world insiders, like Stella Waitzkin, who studied with William de Kooning and lived in the Chelsea Hotel, a residential hotel that was home to many prominent New York City artists in the second half of the 20th century. She cast hundreds of books in resin, a metaphor on knowledge.
And she called her apartment Details of a Lost Library.
Now they sparkle like gems at Art Preserve. For Sam Gatmeyer, executive director of the Art Center, it's intention that sets artist-built environments apart. They're meant to be experienced as a whole.
You know, I think about it in contrast to sort of the norm, which is artists that create serial one-off pieces, right? I make a painting, I sell it. I make another painting, I sell it.
One of Wisconsin's most famous artist-built environments is Fred Smith's Concrete Sculpture Park up in Phillips. He also owned a bar where he sold Rhinelander shorties. Instead of a ticket counter, the first thing museum-goers encounter is a space set up to evoke his establishment.
These kind of reliefs up there were once behind his bar. We kind of use photos at the bar to kind of recreate it, and we're working with a Milwaukee-based artist named John Riepenhoff to brew a Fred Smith lager.
You can still visit Smith's Park and Bar in Phillips, but it's not always possible to preserve artist-built environments where they stand. That's where Art Preserve comes in. Ultimately, its collection celebrates the impulse to create. Gatmeyer envisions a Venn diagram when considering its place in the art world.
For example, most of the artists at the Art Preserve are self-taught, but not all of them are. So one circle we intersect with is self-taught artists, and of course with the institutions like Intuit in Chicago and the Folk Art Museum in New York.
But no other museum places such a focus on artist-built environments. Art Preserve also overlaps with institutions like the Museum of Wisconsin Art that use visible storage to display their collection. Everything is out in the open. The museum is free to visit, and there's plenty to explore on its three floors. But Bickford always ends her tours in the same spot, Emery Blagden's healing machine. The Nebraska artist spent his life investigating Earth's electromagnetism. He filled his shed with sparkling mobiles made from everyday objects like wire, Christmas lights, and bows from the local pharmacy. Blagden called them his pretties.
We call it an artist-built environment. It could equally be a science experiment, like it is a huge sculpture. Maybe it's a machine.
In the end, she says the power is not in the words we use to describe artist-built environments. Rather, it's in the way they bend genres and make us reconsider what constitutes art. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll have some advice for parents on talking to their kids about the dangers of sexting, which has been up a good amount over the pandemic, according to some recent data. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, women's alcohol consumption was going up before the pandemic. What's happened over the last year? A substance abuse expert shares the latest research on women's drinking and why it could be a big problem. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, sexting among teens and tweens has gone on for years, but new data shows it's shot up during the pandemic. Sexting refers to sending nude or suggestive photos, videos, or sexual messages. According to BARC, a service that lets parents and schools monitor kids' devices, the volume of children's text messages that contain sexual content is up 37% from pre-pandemic levels. Most texts are not sexts. Sexting was about 0.5% of all activities 2 years ago. Now it's 0.7%. A 2018 study found that 1 in 7 adolescents have sent sexual texts, 1 in 4 received them, 1 in 8 forwarded them without the consent of the person in the photo. In a 2019 study, girls were 3 times as likely as boys to feel pressured to send a sexual image. So how worried should parents be about their kids sexting, and what can they do about it? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about sexting, or do you not want to see it as a reason to panic? Have you had a conversation about this in your own family, whether you're the parent or, say, the teen yourself? Have you taught kids in schools on how to avoid this kind of thing? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Temple is a psychologist as well as a professor and director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
I think when people hear that sexting is up or worry that their own kids may have been exposed to it or done it themselves, the first instinct as a parent, Jeff, might be panic. But if I understand you correctly, you want to steer us away from that path of panic. Why?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, with any emerging technology, whether it was the phone or the radio or the television or anything, we have a tendency to get very nervous about what it means for our kids because we care about them and we love them. We saw this with Pokemon Go. There were worries about it creating stranger danger. In reality, that never happened. So when we get to sexting, it is scary. You know, that there's these stories we hear about in the news where someone has spread a nude picture of a girl to all the surrounding community and something bad happened. That's the minority of situations. Mostly sexting, even if we don't like it, occurs between consenting adolescents, 16 to 16, 17 to 17-year-old. Again, I'm not saying that this is a condoning it by any means, but if you're a 17-year-old or you have a 17-year-old and he or she is not interested in sex, I'd be equally as worried.
There are concerns, of course, about people being coerced, mostly girls being coerced into sharing explicit images and then being, in effect, blackmailed into sharing more of them. That seems like one of the worst cases we see. What can we do to prevent that?
Yeah, that's really where the public health crisis is with respect to sexting. I'm not so worried about a 17-year-old sending a naked picture to another 17-year-old or receiving one if it's consensual. But when it's coerced or when it's non-consensual, I think that's when we're going to see some of the harmful effects. Just basically like we see with real-life sexual behavior, in-person sex. You know, the line separating online and offline behaviors for this generation of teens is completely blurred. They don't see a difference. So in the same sense, the effects of consensual sex and consensual sexting are probably the same, which is we don't see a whole lot of negative effects. But when it's non-consensual, whether it's in person or over the phone, that's when we start to see some of the negative effects, the anxiety, depression, PTSD, low self-esteem, that sort of thing. So what can we do about it? I think the very most important thing we do is to talk to your kids about sexting, about digital citizenship, about safe sex, about relationships and healthy relationships. You know, if you're in your car right now and you're with your kid, this might be awkward and you might hate me right now, but pull over and have a discussion with your kid about sex and about healthy relationships and continue that conversation. It's not a one-time thing and lean into the awkwardness. It's going to be awkward, but that's okay.
Talking to Jeff Temple, psychologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch, looking at sexting, the sharing of sexual images on social media, on texting, for example, especially among youth, and about how parents can talk to their kids about these issues. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered problems with this in your own family, maybe in your school? Do you have questions about how to have these conversations? What kind of issues to hit? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeff, are there lessons we can learn from those conversations about sexuality in the offline world that can teach us how to have good conversations about online things like sexting?
Yeah, absolutely. And so things like consent, you know, we can talk about how we approach consent with our boyfriends, with our girlfriends, with touching, with anything. And that's the same thing with sexting. You know, we don't want to send something. And most kids, most teens are, you know, they want to be in healthy relationships and they don't want to mess up. Oftentimes it's just not knowing how. And so if we could teach them how to be in a healthy relationship, what that means, then, you know, whether it's in person or over the phone, absolutely there are things that we can replicate that we've done with in-person sex, you know, like things like, you know, being comprehensive in our talks about sexuality and not being naive about it. So that kids are going to think about sex, whether it's in person or online. And so let's open it up and let's have a dialogue about it. What does it mean? What do you hope to get out of it? What are the advantages to waiting? You know, because we do know that things like early sexual debut, again, whether it's in person or early sexting debut, is associated with more harmful effects. So, yeah, just having that ongoing conversation with them about sex and digital citizenship and healthy relationships.
One key difference here, it seems like, Jeff, with it now on the consensual side of things, in-person behavior between a couple teens, it can happen, it can end. If you share that image, it can be sent along, or an impulsive teenager can show it to a buddy who passes it along. There's that risk that that momentary decision can have that really lasting and literally global impact on someone. How do we tackle that issue?
Yeah, that's certainly the, I think the scare of it is, you know, when we were kids, we probably, and you know, I'd say that most all of us who are listening, even if we pretend like we want it, if we had smartphones, we probably would have sexted or have requested a naked picture from our girlfriend or boyfriend. And the difference was when we were growing up, all we had were Polaroids, right? So we could spend a few minutes as the picture develops and decide how stupid we are and put it in our pocket. Or even if we do show people, what the, you know, the most people that are going to see it is a half a dozen or so. So that is the big difference, is now it's immediately at your fingertips, so you don't have those few minutes to think about it. And then it can be shared and reshared and live in perpetuity. So that is the bigger thing that to worry about. And I will say that when we use that kind of like, if it gets out in the world, your life is going to be over and you're not going to get into college and you're going to be kicked off the football team or whatever. I think that's a dangerous thing to do with kids, because we lose our credibility. Those scare tactics just don't work, because they know that a lot of their friends are sexting. They might be sexting and nothing bad is happening. So what I like to do is I approach it like seatbelts. And when I talk to a crowd of kids is, you know, I say, how many of you are going to wear your seatbelt on your way home? And invariably, they all raise their hand. And I say, why? You know, the chance of any of you getting in a car accident on the way home are close to 0%. And the response, of course, is, well, just in case. And so that's how I sort of talk about teens with sexting and with the potential that it could be. It probably won't, but that it could have negative ramifications, long-term ramifications.
I wanted to ask you about preparing kids for what seems like a fairly likely situation, that situation where they're being pressured to share a naked image, a sexualized image, and they don't want to, or they're not sure. What kind of things can we tell kids so that they're ready for that scenario?
Yeah, I love that question. I think our tendency as parents and educators is the sort of the Nancy Reagan thing, just say no. Well, that didn't really work with drugs and alcohol, and it doesn't work with this. There's incredible pressure for teenagers, you know, these 14, 15, 16-year-olds who are looking to fit in and belong and maybe have a crush on someone and want that other person to like them and want to be cool, and their friends are doing it. So there's a lot of pressure. It's much more difficult than the just say no. And in fact, they might want to. So we have to recognize the pressures that they have and get beyond the just say no and give them some real world tactics for dealing with it, and saying, you know, maybe like we do with substance use in the real world or with sex in the real world, there's negotiation, there's refusal skills, and give them those skills to say, well, I'm just not into that right now, or I'm too worried about it ending up on the internet, or something to that effect, to give them those skills and teach them those skills.
We're talking about a rise in sexting among teens with Jeff Temple. He's a licensed psychologist, also professor and director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Texas Medical Branch. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent of youth, of tweens or teens, say, how concerned are you about your kids sexting? Have you had a conversation about it? How did it go? What kind of things did you bring up? Do you want to have a conversation with your kid, or flipping it around, with your parent? Do you have questions for our guest about how to do that, how to make it happen? Even if it's awkward, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about sexting among teens in recent years. Some data shows an increase in sexting, especially during the pandemic. A service that allows parents in schools to monitor kids' devices, it's called Bark, says they're seeing the volume of children's text messages that include sexual content up about 37% from pre-pandemic levels. Jeff Temple is a professor and director of the Center for Violence Prevention at the University of Texas Medical Branch. He's also a licensed psychologist. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this? Have you seen it happen in your family? How have you had a conversation with kids, whether you're a parent or maybe a teacher? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I'm concerned about this. I don't have children myself, but I have nieces and nephews, and I see it in society. So my initial thought is that this is really a matter of emotional maturity, because even in older adults over 30, you can see regression. And what they don't have is an established fundamental sense of self, which began when they were, you know, young or teenager, to give them a strength of spirit or an emotional sense of self, so that they feel empowered to say no when they know it's not a good idea. I wondered what your guests thought about that.
Interesting, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. And Jeff Temple, we've seen adults, mostly men in prominent positions in life, send unsolicited sex over the years. How do we develop maturity to handle these issues at any age?
Yeah, well, first of all, your caller had an excellent name. So I would say,
it's Jeff Day.
Yeah, exactly. If you think of Anthony Weiner, Brett Favre, there's certainly are some prominent examples of older adults who have done this. I really think what Jeff hit on there was what we're trying to do in a lot of our school systems now is teach socio-emotional learning. So to teach kids how to regulate their emotions, how to therefore make better decisions. And really what I focus on is how to have healthy relationships. So, you know, we have all these issues. We have violence, substance use, bullying, sexting now, and who knows, in 10 or 15 years, it might be hologram sexting or something. And I think rather than fighting these issues one at a time in silos, I think the better approach is to target the shared risk and protective factors, like what Jeff, your caller, said, is to focus on that sense of self. And that might mean to teach healthy relationships. So that way, if we can give the kids skills to say no, to solve conflicts in a nonviolent, non-abusive manner, how to break up with someone, how to apologize to someone, just give them those everyday skills of relationship skills, then maybe we can prevent a whole lot of negative behaviors like forwarding sex without consent, non-consensual sexting, violence, substance use, risky sexual behavior, and so forth.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Bill with us in Reedsburg. Bill, hi.
Hi. I'm driving, so if I lose you, I apologize. My concern is, I understand the consensual part, but my concern is that there's a secondary problem, and I work with teenagers a lot. And if a teenager is found with underage pictures on his phone or her phone, they can still get in trouble with the law. It doesn't matter how consensual it is, they can still have problems with it. And there are kids that are basically under court orders right now because of having received pictures that are were inappropriate, and they didn't get rid of them. So I'd like I totally agree with the guest that the biggest and the most important thing is having conversations with your children. Unfortunately, a lot of parents don't.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. You raise a great issue that we haven't touched on, Jeff, the legal side of things.
Yeah, it's an absolutely great point. You know, laws have not caught up with technology. There's still laws in some states where it is legal to have sex if you're 17, but illegal to sext someone. So it's behind the times, so to speak. And in a lot of states, it's still considered a felony. And that's a problem. And it does need to be addressed at the policy level. But what he says is important. And that is something that kids should know and we should communicate to them. That being said, we've looked at this, whether or not kids know the harmful effects from a legal standpoint and whether or not that prevents them from sexting. And probably not a surprise to your listeners, it does not. So we need to do a better job of creating policy that matches up with reality and not punishing teens for kind of expected behavior. What, again, I think we'd all probably be doing if we were 16 and had smartphones. And I think that we need to focus our resources and our efforts in stopping the early sexting, which is associated with negative ramifications, with the non-consensual sexting, with the coerced sexting, pressured sexting, and things like sextortion, where, say, a girl sends a picture of herself to a guy, and then he says, send me more, or I'll send this to all of our friends. So that's the type of things that we need to really focus our efforts on, and not the consensual sharing of photos between two 17-year-olds, say. And I'll also say, if you don't mind, is one of my other pet peeves of this is when a phone is, say, taken at school and there's a picture of a naked girl on it, it's oftentimes that girl is punished for sending it as opposed to that guy for having it on his phone. And you know, I think there's some old school double standard sexism there.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about sexting and youth, Jeff Temple is with us from the University of Texas Medical Branch, licensed psychologist. Jeff, a key here, as we keep coming back to, is good conversations between parents and their kids. The reality in some families is there isn't that relationship. The dynamic is broken for one reason or another. If there's a concerned parent who feels like, for whatever reason, they can't handle that conversation or their kid can't handle their conversation with them, what do you suggest they do? How can they make sure the kid gets that information, even if it isn't sitting down with their parent?
Now, I think this is a common problem. And I'll also say that we should take a belt and suspenders approach, and in that I think we need to be teaching healthy relationships and you know, comprehensive sexual education at school and at the home so that they get it both ways. So if the home is dysfunctional for whatever reason, they're still getting it at school. And if their home is functional and they're getting it at home, well, the worst case scenario is they're getting that message again at school. And that's a good thing. I'll say if you're really uncomfortable with it, you know, find a pro-social adult that person that your child can talk with. Maybe it's an older sibling or a school counselor, someone that they can talk with and have those conversations. I will say that don't avoid it just because it's awkward, though. That's part of the whole thing. We want parents to be awkward about it when they talk to their kids about sex, because that way the kids get to see and model what it's like to have an awkward conversation about sex, which they might be having with their boyfriend or girlfriend in a month or a year. So it lean into that awkwardness and you know, use that as a discussion point. I'll also say that there's constantly stories like this in the news about sexting or about sex. Use that as an opportunity to talk about it. So you don't have to, you know, directly say, are you having sex or are you sexting? You know, say, what do you think about that story that was on the news?
30-second drill, Jeff. The parent sees that their kid, finds out their kid's been involved in sexting one way or another. Give us a quick strategy to not panic before talking about it.
All right. Great question. I'll say, first of all, not panicking is, it does not mean your kid is bad. It doesn't mean your kid is deviant or depressed or anything like that. It probably means that they're a teenager who is interested in sex, especially if it's, you know, 15, 16, older than that. There's not a whole lot of panic to have there. That's the, you know, you don't necessarily want them to do it, but it's a don't panic.
Excellent.
The second part of it is we've done research that shows that sexting precedes actual sexual behavior. So rather than freaking out about it, use that as an opportunity to talk about safe sex and whatever your idea of safe sex is.
And that's where I'll leave it. Jeff Temple was with a psychologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch looking at sexting. You're listening to Central Time. This is a big day for me here at Central Time. This is the first time I am back in our Vilas Hall studio since March of 2020. It hasn't been a secret, but I haven't advertised about it. I've been hosting the show from my house for, what is that, the last 15, 16 months now. And I got to tell you, despite doing it every single day for so many weeks, it never got not weird. I've just set up this sort of half-baked studio in our TV room because that's where the internet came in. And I've got like encyclopedias to stack a microphone on and old beach towels and a sheet hanging up for sound control. It's worked. It's very nice to be back, though, I got to say. So much thanks to so many people who made what should have been an impossible thing work. Our engineering staff, our technical directors, Central Time producers, our management for making it work. I didn't think it could be done, but we obviously did it for so long. And thanks to you, I feel guilty because through all of this, I've felt like I'm more and more connected to people because I get to talk to you every single day. And that's been awesome. So thank you so much for sticking with us. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.